James, so as a machine learning and data science expert, I was just wondering, so how do you choose the research questions that you work on, especially those related to AI?
Yeah, so I mean, I think AI is moving extremely quickly and it's very exciting. So I'm particularly interested in seeing like what are the areas where we can develop new AI tools to make and achieve some societal benefits. Right. And in particular, because a lot of my interest is in these scientific applications, so I'm particularly interested in, can we use AI to make new scientific discoveries? Can we use AI to improve the scientific process?
Exactly.
And then related to that, so what are some of the ways that AI can improve the scientific process? So are there some scenarios? Is this mainly about increasing productivity? Like what are you looking at specifically? And maybe perhaps what have you seen work best so far?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there are many ways where AI can greatly facilitate science. So for example, there are a lot of even more like low-level kinds of data wrangling and like data formatting, right? That typically takes researchers and data scientists a long time to do. But that's, I think that's something that ChatGPT and AI could greatly help to facilitate. There are also areas like, you know, finding relevant references or summarizing information that AI is also becoming quite good at, especially these large language models. But the area of AI where I think it could have the biggest impact in science is really in teaching us how to ask better questions, right? And by that, I mean, like, if you think about the current generation of AI, right? Basically, they're all designed to answer questions, right? You give it, you know, we ask it, okay, what's going on in this image? Or what is X, Y, and Z that will provide an answer. They're not really designed to ask questions, but the scientific process is really more about asking good questions, right? And if you find a good question to ask, then typically people who have enough experience and competence will figure out some answer. But what really separates very interesting research from okay research is really the, you know, who has better questions. And I think that's the area where AI can be the most useful, right? Because, you know, these language models, for example, they have read millions of papers. So it's definitely a lot more papers than I can read in a week, right? And they can see all the connections between papers, right? Gaps between the literature. So if we can teach them to ask better questions, then I think that can be really transformative for science and research and healthcare and medicine. Right? So that's the area that we're actively working on now.
That's interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. How feasible is this? Because as you said, like currently it's just not great at asking questions or even like anything that touches upon creativity, like coming up with new things tends to be a bit, meh, you know, is this just like current technical immaturity or do we need to change the architecture? Like, yeah, how feasible is it that AI will eventually ask really good questions?
I think it's a very promising area. What we're trying to do now is to basically give it basically examples, demonstrations of like what are some good questions and some good ideas or good hypotheses to test, right? Because for example, like these language models at ChatGPT, if you can give them enough examples and then to train them or fine tune them, then they can start to learn from that very quickly. Right. And I think the tricky part is like, how do we find good examples of like what are really good research questions, right? Compared to what are maybe like, okay, research questions. And one way we've been doing this is to basically go through, for example, papers published in different AI conferences where the reviews are public, right? And the scores by the reviewers are public, right? So we can then extract those and say, okay, so here are the papers that these, the humans experts consider to be the very novel or very impactful ideas, right? And then use those as basically some proxy of a training signal to train the large language models to improve the kinds of questions that they can help to generate, right? I guess our overall vision here is that maybe researchers like us, like we will give the algorithm some half-baked ideas, right? And then the algorithm will tell us, okay, how do you then sharpen those ideas or hypotheses to make it more novel, more impactful, more actionable, right? And also help us to design experiments that can effectively test these hypotheses and ideas.
All right. So looking at all these examples of like research questions, like have you also done like, I don't know, factor analysis or something? Like can you give me like the characteristics of a really good, really impactful research question?
Yeah. So there's actually quite a rich literature, right? In both like the science of science, the sociology of science, of people studying like what But what makes it, what enables scientific innovation, right? What leads to these jumps, right? And people have come up with different criteria, right? Of things like, what does it mean to be novel, right? And how do you identify sort of gaps in the literature? Like, in order to be novel and impactful, first you want to have read a lot of the literature and see if here are some of the missing gaps, right? And a lot of things like, you know, interdisciplinary research, right? How do we take ideas from two different fields and then combine them together? Those tends to be more interesting, impactful. And that's actually something I think language models can be particularly good at, right? Because it has seen such diverse set of fields, right? Like ChatGPT has read all of the PubMed articles and archive and code bases and GitHub. And so it's seen a lot more diversity of things than we have. So if we can teach it how to make these connections between different fields, then it could actually come up with a lot more even low-hanging fruit kind of ideas that we just haven't made ourselves because we haven't read as many papers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And it kind of makes me think of like the role of a good mentor or also peer reviewer, right? Like a lot of, like a big part of peer review for a journal, for an article to be published in a journal is also, is this novel enough to be published in this journal that only cares about novel research, right? So do you see generally peer review as also as part of what AI can do? I know we talked about it a little bit in your seminar. Like, is AI eventually going to be in a place where it can judge what humans or maybe other AIs put in and be an arbiter of like, yes, this is a good question, proceed, or like, no, this is inappropriate?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think AI can be an important assistant in the peer review process. I think we still do need to have human experts to provide their own independent and deep assessments of the work, right? To be really the final gatekeeper of the peer review process. But as you know, the peer review process is currently heavily overburdened by a great amount of papers that are coming out. And the second is also everybody's busy, and it's often hard, it's difficult to find reviewers who have enough time to provide quick feedback, right? Which is why now the peer review process often drags on for many months, sometimes years, which can really be a huge bottleneck towards scientific innovation. I think that's one area where AI can be very useful in providing at least more rapid, short-term feedback, especially on earlier stages of research works, right? So imagine if you are, you know, maybe from an under-resourced place where it's hard to find mentors, right? Or if you're like a more junior researcher and it's hard to get time from the more senior experts, instead of waiting for months and maybe even years to get feedback, we've seen that, for example, large language models can also provide sometimes useful feedback, right? Because it's able to see, say, like, here are some of the literature, here's how you can improve the novelty of your work, right? And that can be very timely and very useful for, especially for junior researchers.
Yeah. So I actually experimented with that a little bit. So I asked ChatGPT to write peer reviews for some of the manuscripts that I've written. And I must honestly say that in some cases, the AI feedback was at least as good, if not better, than the referee reports that I got in the real world. And also in the data that that you showed us, it was actually, I found it pretty surprising that, you know, this overlap between AI feedback and human feedback is pretty similar to the overlap between two humans. So, I mean, all of that seems very, very promising, but you know, the economist in me is worrying a little bit about the incentive problem here, right? So because it is extremely cheap and extremely fast to generate peer review with AI, right? So it's like it literally takes you like 10 seconds. And as a referee, you literally have no incentive, no explicit incentive of actually investing time and effort into doing a thorough peer review. So it seems to me that the rational strategy for everybody in the scientific enterprise is nowadays that they just, instead of writing peer reviews themselves, they just ask ChatGPT to do it for them, which would result in a situation where we actually don't really have meaningful human feedback anymore. And where sort of all the biases that we have in AI models would very quickly propagate throughout the scientific ecosystem. So what do you think about that?
I think that's a really interesting and important question. it also speaks to some of the deeper, broader issues, right, around the incentives of peer review. Because even prior to the language models, right, reviewers are basically volunteers, right? They're not getting paid or compensated. And which is why, the reason why all of us, we contribute peer reviews is because we felt some sort of community norm. Like if we publish papers in a journal, then we feel like we should also review and help review those journals.
Exactly.
And I think that kind of community norm, exactly, reciprocity to help our colleagues, right, pay it forward. I think that kind of community norm is still what's needed to bind all of the systems together, even in the era of generative AI, right? So even when there are generative AI that can make peer review very fast, right, we still feel the need because we feel responsible for our community that we should provide our own feedback and try to help and provide constructive feedback to papers where we can.
Hey there. I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. If you do, please take a sec to leave a review or subscribe to this podcast to help us reach more people. Thanks.
So the question then is, of course, so how would an editor who typically is like the ultimate arbiter in this peer review process, how would an editor be able to tell if a referee has actually exerted efforts to write the peer review themselves and like actually exerted their human knowledge and expertise, or if they just delegated it to an AI? So how can we actually make sure that the norms that we were trying to enforce up to now are still in place?
Yeah. So I think there are some mechanisms where they can help to facilitate this. I think some of the journals, for example, encourage the reviewers to actually have conversations with each other, right? So more like real-time discussions so they can come to some consensus of the work. I think that's helpful. I think many of the journals are also encouraging people to publish the reviews or to make the reviews public. And that's not the case for a lot of, for example, the AI conferences. But it's also become more of the case for interdisciplinary journals like Nature. And I think people also feel like once the reviews are public, they feel more responsibility, even if it's still anonymous, they feel more responsibility to make sure those are high quality. And because they feel like they're accountable for something that's out in the public domain, right? So totally. I think there are these kind of mechanisms that can still help to encourage and incentivize reviewers.
Yeah. I can totally see how this would work, right? I mean, as a referee, if you know that your referee report is going to be public, you're going to be worried that if you just generate an AI report, that it's going to be the same report that the other person is posting, which would look really bad for both of you, right?
Yeah.
I could totally imagine that, that something like that would help.
Yeah, we do see is that when we compare the AI generated reviews feedback compared to the feedback from the human experts, right, the AI generated feedback tends to be more like in the medium, right, where closer to the consensus of the human feedback, which just means like AI has this sort of homogenizing effect, right? So like humans tend to provide more diverse feedback and opinions, and AI tends to be closer to the consensus,
right?
And which is also an interesting question, right? Because I think especially for certain authors, it's actually useful for them to see the more extreme feedback. Right, so they can get the diversity of opinions from different fields.
Yeah, very much so.
Definitely. We actually recently had a guest also on the podcast, James Evans, and we talked about basically the importance of diversity, in like scientific perspectives and like teams that work together and teams that come together from different fields of science, different perspectives, different expertises, come together to work on the same problem, bring in their different perspectives, and then actually come up with the more innovative solutions rather than teams that like come in with a very homogenous perspective from the get-go. So do you worry about like AI being more and more involved in the scientific process that actually we lose this diversity of perspectives and then eventually end up with less and less innovative ideas?
I do a bit, yes. And so James Evans has done some really exciting pioneering work in looking at how, innovation in particular, how that arises from this diversity, which I really like. And I do think that if we just use AI, at least the current type of AI, right? So it does tend to be less diverse and more homogeneous in the feedback and ideas they come up with. That being said, I think there are also some interesting ways of trying to make the AI more diverse, right? So for example, one thing that we have experimented with is see, okay, can we have the AI, when it's say, for example, trying to provide feedback for researchers, can we ask it to do role play, right? So imagine if you are, let's say, a more statistically minded reviewer, right? What would you say? Or imagine if you are a more empirical reviewer or a more theoretical reviewer. And now the AI, like ChatGPT, they are becoming better and better at role-playing different persona, right? And I think that could be one way to get more diverse feedback from the model is by asking it to role-play different types of perspectives.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. And it also reminds me a little bit of one of the empirical results that you were talking about in your seminar, where you basically compared the type of comments that ChatGPT is giving versus humans, right? And there seem to be some particular patterns that emerge. So ChatGPT was more likely to comment on the implications of the research, but much less likely to comment on theoretical soundness. And I just wonder, like, do we understand why LLMs are currently behaving that way? So what is driving that behavior, and how we can potentially steer it in a direction that that is more beneficial?
Yeah, it's a good question. Some of those reflect, I think, limitations of the current language models, right? For example, there's the latest version of GPT-4 Vision, which is not able to understand some of the scientific figures. But when we tested the ability of the vision part, so the vision part is actually still quite a bit behind the language part, right? In the sense that there's still a lot of scientific figures, even charts and plots or more complicated figures where the vision does not fully understand, right? Or at least not to the capability of expert human reviewers. And I think that's also leading to some of the potential limitations in the feedback that the model can give, at least the current model can give, right? If it doesn't really understand fully like what's going on in each of the tables, that can lead to some more less deep technical feedback. Of course, maybe the same could be also set for human reviewers. I mean, a lot of reviewers also do not go into every supplementary figure and table, and maybe they don't fully read everything yet.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. So coming back to this incentive problem, so one of the things that I'm a little bit worried about is that when AI tools are getting so incredibly good and productive and easy to use, don't they decrease the incentive for people to invest into becoming expert themselves? Isn't there a danger that we begin relying on these tools too much, which then in turn would mean that, you know, the new data that these models are being trained on are actually decreasing in quality, and that we may actually reinforce errors and biases from the early days and slow down progress as a result of that?
I agree. I think there is that concern. And for example, now that coding is becoming much easier, right, with AI assistants like Copilot, now there's not less of a need for coders or for students either to memorize what exact Python package or R package to use.
Sure,
right? Because then that's something that AI can just do it for you. And I think that's can also be a good thing as well, right? Because that means that some of them, perhaps lower level things like exactly the syntax of the code or which package to use, those are offloaded to the model. So students don't have to memorize those. As teachers, we can try to shift their time, focus on more of the high level things, like what's the overall structure of a code, right? Or how do you debug the algorithm efficiently, right? Or how do you really evaluate your algorithm, right? And those things that are still important and really requires human attention, I think those become even more important because now we have to teach the researchers and teach the students how do you evaluate an output of language model, right, efficiently. So I think to answer your question, yes, there will be some things that people will have less incentives to learn, like the more low level, for example, coding could be one of those examples. At the same time, I think we also want to shift people's energy and focus to other areas where it becomes even more important, like how do you monitor and how do you evaluate outputs, right, potentially from AI models.
So it sounds to me that, the likely scenario is one where people that have just an average level of expertise, their skills could relatively easily be supplemented or substituted with AI, Whereas people that have really deep expertise and that can actually very productively work together with AI, their productivity is going to skyrocket. And that in turn would probably like increase the divide that we already have, right? So it would basically mean that we have much higher income and career opportunities for these very, very few that have this extremely high productivity. Whereas for the rest, it may not be so positive. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting. So for a few years now, right, people have been talking about, is AI going to replace doctors?
Right.
And that's actually one of the earlier examples when deep learning was becoming more popular. People say, yeah, deep learning is going to replace radiologists. And I quite like a comment that one of my colleague, Kurt Langlott, said. So he's also an MD. What he said is that AI is not going to, unlikely to replace doctors, but doctors that learn how to use AI is going to replace doctors that do not know how to use AI.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And I think that seems to be the pattern now, right? So radiologists or doctors that can learn to use AI effectively are becoming more efficient, more productive compared to earlier versions of themselves, right? And I think that's going to be the trend in a lot of different areas, right? Where we do need to think about how to like up level and educate the workforce to effectively use the AI technologies and use the algorithms. So, I mean, it's like, you know, when internet was becoming more popular, right? So people who can really learn how to use Google effectively, they're just much more productive. And when we need to go through a sort of similar transition to teach people how to effectively use language models.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Let's maybe talk about another use case of AI. So there's also this idea that AI, having all this input, right, and this big processing power, we could use it to basically simulate a lot of different scenarios and perhaps generate data that might be very hard to just mm-hmm. obtain or collect in the real world, mm-hmm. right? So basically, you're missing some data. You just ask ChatGPT, like, "Hey, give me the data for that." How confident are you in this approach? Like, should we use AI to simulate data on like real world scenarios and like research objectives? Or is that dangerous given all the like hallucinations that we currently see?
Yeah.
How do you feel about this topic?
I think AI generated synthetic data is an extremely interesting, important area. I think for some applications, the AI generated synthetic data is already quite effective, right? One application would be for example, some of the smaller language models, right? When people try to teach those models like Llama, right? So they're actually most of the time using data, synthetic data that are produced by larger language models like GPT-4, right? So it's sort of like mm-hmm. having a large model generate synthetic data as teaching material to teach some of the smaller AI systems, right? And now there are even systems like where you can have the large language model generate their own training data, right, to teach themselves, right? So it's some sort of like self-teaching, self-reward mechanisms. I think those are quite interesting and promising approaches where AI-generated synthetic data can be used to improve other AI systems. Now, in simulation settings, I think there's still a lot of limitations in what AI is able to simulate, right, or emulate. One big area is that I think it's still quite challenging for the current language models and AI to really emulate sort of longitudinal behaviors of individual humans, mm-hmm. right? For example, if I look at Carla or look at Philip, like over time, right, like you have some consistent personalities and traits that show up across multiple days. And the AI algorithm, because it's trained on these more just the homogeneous data, right, doesn't know which data come from which individual, it's very hard for it to actually maintain a consistent persona across time. Mm-hmm. Right. And in particular, I think it's very difficult to emulate the persona of someone who's learning, who's evolving across time, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, like right. you, right? And all of us, like we change from day to day because of the new information that we absorb, right? And we change in different trajectories, right? Different ways because we all have different encounters every day. And I think that's actually something very difficult for the current AI to emulate.
Yeah, totally. And I think in this context, it's also important to keep in mind that LLMs, in general, they're correlational models, right? So they're not causative models. So like one instance where this like is obviously very relevant is when you're trying to impute data and then actually understand mechanisms. So you had a really nice example in your talk where you had this example of the tech transfer office at Stanford, where you use a large language model to basically help to classify ideas that are more likely to have commercial success. And the AI was actually doing really well at that, but it came up with some really unintuitive correlations, right? So for example, you had like this negative correlation with the outcome with words such as novel, significant, effective, patented, critical, improved, beneficial, yeah. dramatic, right? So that seems to me that, you know, like it's a very nice like illustration of this correlation versus causation concept, right? So because it's obviously picking up something that is correlated with lower success, but like if the words would have been used accurately, they should be positively associated yeah. with it, right? So quite likely what it's capturing is actually some unobserved underlying mechanism that is driving the data, such as overconfidence of researchers yeah. or them trying way too hard to sell a bad idea. And then and that just basically shows us that what this is doing is it's like it's picking up correlational data that may actually be very, very different from the underlying data generating process, the causal model, right? So my worry is that if we rely on the convenience of that too much, that we may actually end up in a scenario where we end up understanding much less about the world, or where we draw completely wrong conclusions about it.
I agree. I think there's even one more layer on top of that, which is what we call sort of performativity, right? So the idea being that when we actually deploy that AI model, it's going to change human behaviors, right? In a way that's going right. to right. make the predictions harder. So for example, yeah. if I release a model that says that, if you say novel in your application or smaller or faster or cheaper in your application, it's less likely to get funded. Then the human yeah. inventors are going to be incentivized to not use those words. Right? Yeah. And then mm-hmm. that itself is going to affect, make it more likely for the AI classifier to make more mistakes, right? There's, mm-hmm. I think, a really interesting feedback loop where yeah. the deployment of an AI model, the fact that the model is actually being used is actually going to change the data distribution, change how people behave, that mm-hmm. makes it more likely mm-hmm. for that model to make mistakes. And I think that's something that the current yes. AI is not able to address very effectively.
Right, interesting. Okay, so somewhat related, but yeah, so you use this AI tool to kind of analyze what science translates well into like successful startups or technologies that are then commercialized. What other analyses can we do with AI on top of science? So not using AI for scientific research itself, but rather analyze science as it's being done, like the impact of it or like the importance of it, the relevance. So essentially using AI for science on science. What are the applications that you see and how can it help the scientific system? And what are the dangers, like also related to what you just said? Once we know we're going to adjust our behavior, how do we circumvent that?
Yeah, I think there are lots of interesting opportunities to using AI to study the science and system of science, right? Because a lot of the scientific outputs, right, it's really in terms of text. So you have all these papers, you have like grant proposals, you have patents. And in the past, it's often one challenging part is to extract structured information from those texts, right? Like you want to say, okay, so how much is paper A influenced by paper B? Well, how do we really do that? Before, maybe we'd just look at citation, but we know that's a very coarse proxy. But now if you have a language model that's actually read paper A and B, right, then the model can tell us in a lot of the cases, okay, like is A really, how much A is really influenced by B, right? How similar are their ideas? Mm-hmm. Right. So I think it's really a very powerful tool because it's able to process these millions of texts, right, unstructured text in parallel and giving us these quantifiable relationships between the text. And in particular, we've been using this to help us to also look at like patent applications of all these millions of patent applications and seeing how do they really relate to the underlying research, right, that were citing the patents and basically how much do the patents refer to the research, and what's the connection between them, how novel is the patent. So for that kind of analysis, it's been very useful to use the AI as a tool.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. It kind of opens up a new type of impact factor, right? Like if you can, like having read all the papers, it could help us understand like, oh, this paper from way back then, like its ideas keep getting propagated. So like high impact back there. And then all these new papers that get cited a lot because they have a lot of friends or whatever, actually not that many ideas really make it across to different fields or whatever. That's really interesting. I like that.
Yeah. I think related to that, it's also very interesting, at least for the people who are interested in like the science of science, to study the science of the impact of language models and AI on science, right? Because this is probably the one of the biggest transformations that's happened in recent years, right? And it's happening as we speak in real time, right? So I would really encourage people in that community to study this as a really interesting natural experiment, right? How this is actually changing the way that we do science.
Very much.
And just to give you an example, like we talked about the peer review, how much people use peer review. So we have a really very recent paper that we put out online last week. I didn't talk about it in the presentation, but where we actually tried to estimate, right, what fraction of the peer reviews from the past year have actually been significantly modified or even generated by AI. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And we did this. We looked at, for example, their specific adjectives and words like commendable, right? That most humans don't really use that. They don't use commendables. If you look at the usage of commendable in reviews, it's very low. But that's something that, for whatever reason, ChatGPT really likes to use. And we also saw that if you look at the reviews published in the last 12 months, right, there's a huge spike in the words, usage of words and adjectives like commendable. And using those adjectives, we estimated that about 15% of the reviews, at least in a lot of the top AI conferences, have been substantially modified by a large language model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is exactly what we were talking about earlier, right? I mean, the incentives are clearly like pointing towards researchers trying to do that instead of like exercising effort and putting in a lot of time to do that manually. And like one of the related phenomena that we now also see, which is causing quite a bit, outcry on social media, is that the big publishers all seem to get flooded now with AI generated content that isn't clearly, marked or like declared as such, right? So you see published articles that have clearly copy pasted output from ChatGPT where it says, as a large language model, I do not have access to the last 2 years of blah, blah, right? And nobody spotted these things. And it's incredibly embarrassing for the publishers. But I think what is even worse is that it sort of like undermines our trust in how we do science. And it really seems like that this combination of like AI and these bad incentives that we have in science lead to this perfect storm where now all of a sudden people have the tools to make it just very, very easy and efficient for them to basically cheat. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that is, I've seen some of these examples too, and I think those are quite egregious, right? The very obvious ones that you can sort of catch them by looking for these telltale signs, like as the AI system, blah, 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 right? And there are ones that are much harder to catch, right? Where people, maybe we use AI to write some things, and then they would maybe do a quick pass to edit, right? And then remove some of these telltale signs. And then I think those would be quite challenging to detect. There's even a third version, which one might argue is perhaps more benign, right? Where people will still come up with like, let's say a very rough draft of their paper or of their review, maybe in bullet points, and just have the AI to flesh out and expand those bullet points into more polished papers, right? But in those cases, maybe the ideas still come from the original human, but the AI just serves as the writing assistant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that can be very effective actually, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that can be very effective. And that's the tricky part. It's often challenging, very challenging for us to distinguish between, like, are we in the first scenario, right? Yeah. Or in the second scenario where AI is more of a writing assistant.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, like when I'm working with my PhD students, like many of them, they're extremely like talented and well-trained when it comes to quantitative analysis, but writing isn't like their biggest fortune. And very often, like I simply recommend them, you know, write down your first thoughts and then, you know, run it through an AI and then use that and iterate further. And yeah, often this leads to much, much better text that they produce, and they do it much, much faster. Mm-hmm. But it sort of raises the question. So what, like there's obviously cases where it's completely okay to do it. There is cases where it's obviously completely wrong to do it. And there is this large area in the middle. So how do we deal with that? Like, do you have any ideas like how we could have policies in place or even like enforce standards or develop standards that that would help us to deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the end, we still have to be very clear that the human researchers, right, like if you are an author or co-author of the paper, then you have to be completely responsible for everything that's published and submitted, right? That's the case, especially if the researcher right. uses the AI as a writing assistant tool. Maybe the AI is yeah. used to generate references or to flesh things out. Maybe that might be okay, but the human researchers still have to be, say, okay, I put my stamp behind this 100%. I take mm-hmm. responsibility mm-hmm. for everything that's written, for all mm-hmm. the references. Mm-hmm. I think this kind of accountability by the authors becomes even more important, right? And I think transparency is also important, right? So I think, you know, I don't want to stigmatize people from using AI tools as writing assistant because I agree with you. Yeah. A lot of people do benefit from it, especially, for example, if they're not native English speakers, then this can be
right, exactly.
a big time saver.
Yeah.
Right. People should use them effectively, and maybe you just want to be more transparent and say, okay, yeah, did the AI help you to polish the work? If it is, that's okay. You can say that. If the AI helped you to generate the ideas, right. I think people should also not be ashamed to say that too, because more and more people are going to be using it that way.
Exactly.
Yeah. I feel like this also begs the question, like, is a paper, like a written piece of text, is that still what we should define as the scientific output? Like, given that we have this tool which can use data and then translate that data into a response that I can understand personally with my background, my specific questions, shouldn't the role of a researcher just be find and collect the right data, run a good analysis, perhaps helped by AI as well, but then put that out into the world, and then any reader of scientific content can just ask the question like, hey, I have this question and I need some evidence, some like other research on this, and then I just get surfaced the information rather than like a text that was written by somebody else and then also 100 other texts written by someone else or an AI, which I don't know, right? Why don't we just like use data and like the analysis and the outcomes and the results of the analysis as the like output of science? And then we use AI and LLMs on top just as a communication layer between that data, quote unquote, truth, and then us who like can't read the data as fluidly as we can read text.
I think that would be a very interesting world, a very interesting future where humans would just guide data generation, right? And all the interpretation of the data is done by the AI algorithm. And we ask the questions, like you said, and the algorithm will provide answers based on its reading of the data. I mean, I think that could be very effective and very interesting, right? I think one current limitation, at least with the current data, is that there's a lot of context, right? Behind how the data is actually generated, mm-hmm. that is often not very well captured, right? And maybe it's like just sort of the secret knowledge that the authors themselves know, right? So how exactly did they produce this experiment? How did they get the data? Mm-hmm. And effectively what we're asking for in the artifact, right, that's the paper, is that the authors should somehow leverage their private context behind the data and then use that to help us to interpret the results. Right. And that private context is something that's hard to transfer over to the AI system. But if we do maybe in the future move into a world in some domains where the data generation is very systematic, right? There's really very little private context for each individual researcher. Everybody's using the same experimental protocols. They're generating similarly quality data. then it could be feasible is to put all of that data out there and have the AI, one AI to interpret all of that data together.
Well, everybody comes in with their own AI to like interpret the data in whatever, you know, like, and then also with like, even if the way that you collect data is not standardized, like that's also just another piece of data. It's metadata, right? Like how was this data produced? How was it obtained? If that's publicly available in conjunction with the data, and that can help, again, me coming in with my personal AI that's prompted to explain this as if I was five, right? And then it just explains it all to me.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's actually another like really interesting and useful application, right? So summarizing text or like breaking them down in a way that they become humanly understandable, right? So you had this nice example with the consent forms in medical research, right? So where the original is very often not penetrable to normal people, but AI can actually translate it in a way that even my granny would understand it. So that's a very useful application.
Yeah.
A little bit of a philosophical question for you. So do you think that AI systems are actually capable of understanding? And if so, how is that different from human understanding? Or is it? Would it literally be the same?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still being debated of what do we really mean by understanding, right? But I think from all the practical operational versions of it, right? Like, I think AI is able to understand a lot of the scientific concepts and is able to do, you know, often pretty sophisticated reasoning on top of scientific concepts. It still makes a lot of mistakes, which is why we need to check it, but so do humans. We also make mistakes. But I think AI is able to provide, to do a lot of the scientific reasoning, also provide sort of steps of its logical and reasoning process.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Carla, should we switch gears and go to our lightning round?
I think we should. I can hear the thunders rumbling.
Yes, me too. Me too. I didn't even know where it comes from.
All right, James. Question number one. Short question, short answer. Should AI be regulated? Yes or no?
Yes. Thoughtfully, yes. We need to be very thoughtful about regulation, but yes.
Interesting. Second one. What's the best use case for AI that you've seen so far?
I think actually using AI to simplify information and make to broader public and to patients, right? I think that's actually a very good use case because there are a lot of technical concepts that AI is actually very good at explaining.
Mm-hmm. If you could decide to live either in the real world or in a virtual reality that you designed, which would you choose?
The real world, yeah. I have too many
with all the pains.
People that I... yeah. I too many people that I enjoy interacting with. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, same for me. Okay, next one. What is your spirit animal?
You know, there's a bird that comes to our house every morning, right, and tries to like tap on the window to get in. So maybe that is the spirit animal.
Wow, that is super nice. I like that.
That's cute. Do you ever let it in, or does it sadly keep knocking?
It's very regular. It counts like between 9 and noon every day, and it always taps on the window. But we figured it's actually safer to not let it in, so it can enjoy the freedom outside.
Yeah.
Sure.
That's amazing.
All right. James, would you go to a music concert that's entirely performed by an AI?
Yes. I think that would be super fun.
Mm-hmm.
That is so interesting. So you think people would actually be into it? Like, would they actually cheer for their favorite AI and have like posters on the wall and like get really excited?
Throw their bras on the stage.
Yeah, I would love to go to an AI concert.
That's cool. I would totally go with you. I think like at least for a one-time performance, I would totally be up for it. And then I could make up my mind if I thought it's good enough for a second try.
Okay, I would only go if it's like, if there's these Android robots, like Daft Punk style, that are performing, you know?
Yeah.
That would be my criterion.
Yeah, let's do it.
Sounds great.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, James. This was great. Thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It was great fun, and thanks so much for sharing your time and your wisdom with us. We'll share it further with the rest of the world. Thanks, James.
Yeah, thanks. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Future of Science podcast. If you liked this episode, please remember to review and subscribe to this podcast. You can learn more about the DSciFoundation at dscifoundation.org. See you next time.